Okay, this is talking to Dick Thompson at the VLA in Socorro, New Mexico on 1st May, 1978. Well, can you tell me what your educational background was and when you first came in contact with radio astronomy?
All right. I went to a grammar school in England. It was actually Beverley Grammar School, and from there I got a state scholarship to Manchester University. I took physics, which I was interested in, and the physics department at Manchester was running Jodrell Bank, of course, and I got interested in that. And during my first summer as an undergraduate, I went out to Jodrell and was a summer student there. That would be the summer of 1950, and I mainly worked there were helping one of the guys who was doing experiments on meteor radar. It was the radiant experiment.
What was his name?
Let me think. I have difficulty recalling it.
That's okay.
He's not in radio astronomy now. He left, and I think he went into electronic industry or something like that. I remember spending a couple of days during the summer helping Hanbury Brown and Hazard move the tilting mast of the 280-foot
to a different declination.
A different declination, that's right. But mainly I was working with the media people. Then the following summer I wasn't at Jodrell. The summer after that, which was the summer I graduated with a bachelor's degree, I was there again. What was I doing that second summer as a graduate student? I've forgotten whether I was working with Jennison or Hanbury Brown or who. Well, never mind, that's not important. Then I decided I'd like to do a PhD and do work in radio astronomy. So I went to Jodrell, and three of us went from the physics department that year. There was Matthew Dagg, myself, and Colin Gill. Matthew Dagg worked with Alan Maxwell. They had an experiment where they were following Cygnus or Cassiopeia to measure ionospheric scintillations.
Right.
Dagg, after he got his PhD, he went to Cambridge and took a course in soil physics, and I think he's now director of a research station in Africa.
I see.
Gill did an experiment with, not R.D. Davies, the other Davies, John Davies.
J.G.
Davies, yes. Right. And that was a meteor experiment in which they had three stations. I think they transmitted only from Jodrell, but there were three receiving stations. This allowed one to pinpoint an orbit and get an orbit exactly.
From the different Doppler shifts.
Yeah,
different,
that's right. But they could get both. They could get the precise orbit, which you can't do by just looking at it with a with transmitting and receiving from the same place. And this was to see if there were any meteors with hyperbolic orbits. And they did that experiment. Gill got his PhD and left. I said, I think he went into one of the British government agencies. I'm not sure which. And then I joined Hanbury Brown, who at that time was thinking about making an interferometer with an antenna, a movable antenna, using the 218-foot dish with the tilting mast as being the main antenna. And the dish was implemented for 158 megahertz, which was a fairly high frequency in
right.
those days.
Right.
We made an interferometer.
Well, before you go on, let me just ask: how was it determined that you would join him? Were you just assigned to that group, or did you have a choice?
Well, there were. I remember Lovell telling me that there were three possibilities, three people who were working there at the time who wanted. Who wanted graduate students
right.
to join them. And of the three of us going, Gill and Dagg and I, we settled it between ourselves. I think my preference was to join Hanbury, though I did wonder about doing the meteors. And Gill, I think, said, well, he'd just as soon do the meteors, and Dagg did the other one, and that's the way it worked out. Kind of by mutual agreement.
Okay, and now Hanbury at this time, had not done any interferometry, or is that true? Or was he already working on the intensity interferometer at that time?
He had given the idea of the radio version of the intensity interferometer to Jennison, and Jennison and Dasgupta had made it. And about that summer, let's see.
That would be
52.
Right.
Not the summer of 52. Jennison and Dasgupta were about to make their first measurements, and with the radio intensity interferometer. The interferometer that we were going to build was going to be a regular interferometer with a cable or radio link. We made a fairly transportable antenna. I actually made most of it myself, made out of 2x4s bolted together with bolts, and it had four frame sections, each of which had, I think, it had four full-wave dipoles on each frame section, and the frames stood side by side, and then a single screen of chicken wire as a ground plane went underneath the layer of dipoles.
And this all folded up nicely to be put in the back of the truck?
Yeah, pretty much. It came into the four frames took down, and I think it was possible. I've forgotten whether we moved them as they were or whether we took the legs off, but one way or the other we moved them fairly easily. The interferometer was made in such a way that the master local oscillator was at the remote station, so that the LO and the IF were going down the same way from the remote station to the home station down the cable, which made it a little bit easier to make. And then we separated the signals at the home station, which mm-hmm. was a hut at Jodrell Bank, which was called the Park Royal. I don't know whether you ever knew about
Park Royal.
Did you know about
it? No, I haven't heard that term.
Oh, well, apparently in the early days of Jodrell Bank, they had a lot of trailers. And one of them had the word Park Royal on. That was a part of London, and this trailer was an old military trailer,
right.
And it had been built by a company there, but it got to be known as the Park Royal trailer.
I see.
And when they built, when they replaced it with a building, they kept calling it the Park Royal building. And then the other building was the Moon Hut, and the
Moon Hut was for
Lunar radar. There was a Meteor Radiant Hut, there was, I've forgotten the names of the others, well, it doesn't really matter. We separated the signals there and used, we separated the IF coming in from the remote station from the LO signal, which was, I think, a 10 megahertz crystal, which we'd multiplied up to 150 to beat with the incoming signal at 158, something like that, and then we beat down to a similar IF the signals coming in from the 280 foot diameter antenna, and the output went on a chart recorder. When we got to long spacings with that system,
you successfully moved out, I guess, going further and further. Was that the idea?
Yes, well, that's right. I remember, let me go back. At the time, Henry Brown had produced a catalogue of radio source at 158 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
And comparing this with the catalogue which Ryle had produced, a certain number of sources which Henry found near the galactic plane, and these, of course, were found with the same antenna, 280-footer, but in a single-dish mode.
Right.
The ones near the galactic plane were not in Ryle's survey. Now, it turned out that most of the ones near the galactic plane were large supernova remnants,
right.
which were half a degree in size upwards, almost to the beam width of the antenna. And we found that it was very difficult for us to get our antennas close enough together to mm-hmm. pick up these big ones. They were almost fully they were resolved to maybe 50% or so, even when we had the two antennas sitting right side by side.
I see.
With the rest of the sources, we had absolutely the opposite problem, that we couldn't go far enough to resolve them. We ended up by taking the antenna out to the Cat and Fiddle hill, which kind of hill or mountain in Derbyshire, which was line of sight from Jodrell Bank, And that was the longest basing we used. I was there about 3.5 years at John Law.
How long was that baseline, roughly?
Well, let me see. If I may consult. There's an observatory paper, which you probably have the...
the one in 57 with the...
Morris Palmer and Thompson.
Right, right.
Okay, and was 10,600 wavelengths at...
2 meters, roughly?
Yeah, at 158 megahertz, so you could figure that out. I think, actually, we
About 20 kilometers, then.
Yeah, we didn't... I don't think we said exactly what it was in miles or kilometers.
Well, that's all right. It's roughly 20 kilometers. But what I wanted, did you make a big jump out to this 20 kilometers from your previous baseline, or was it
gradual? No, we went out to three or four intermediates. Well, let me give you again what they are in wavelengths. Wrong one.
And so it was a successive effort to try to resolve these things.
That's right. We'd gone to 56 wavelengths, I guess, when the antennas were almost close together, then 480, 630, 980, 2060, 6700, and 10,600. So there was an attempt to go roughly in factors of two or so, depending on where there was convenient site to put the antenna,
right,
where somebody friendly would let us plug into their electric power supply.
Right. How long did it take you to set up and change stations?
Oh, setting up would be a matter of a day or maybe a day or 2 days. Then, you see, we observed only at meridian transit. We would tilt the antenna so that it would be at the appropriate declination.
Mm-hmm.
And then let the source go overhead. We'd probably stay 3 or 4 weeks by the time we got good records and things. And
so you were, and were these baselines all roughly east-west?
No.
No?
Here again, just a moment,
Well, in any case, if you're observing in meridian, you're only getting the east-west structure.
No, you're getting the structure with regard to whatever the baseline is.
No, but only in the east-west direction, though.
Well, if the antennas are separated on an east-west line, then you only get the east-west
component
of the structure. But if the antennas are at some other angle,
that's what I'm trying to get at. Were you worried about that effect, or were you just the possibility of asymmetric sources?
At that time, that was kind of a secondary consideration, No, essentially we weren't. What we were trying to do was see what we could resolve. You see, at that time, Cygnus and Cassiopeia had been resolved with the intensity interferometer, the radio version of the intensity interferometer.
Right.
And what we're just trying to push things in the same direction for some of the weaker sources. Now, at the same time, Mills had an interferometer in Australia,
right,
which was a radio link device, and it went out to a few kilometers, and I think it worked at a somewhat lower signal frequency, either 80 or 120 megahertz.
I think you're right. I think it was around 78 or something, right?
Yeah, okay. And he was kind of the competitor in the game at
mm-hmm.
that time. We eventually went further than he did, and for a while we held the record for long baseline interferometry. The journal back to the cat and fiddle was the record for long baseline interferometry for a while. I might mention that in this earlier group of sources that we looked at, the ones which we found it difficult to resolve, one of them was one that Hanbury Brown used to called a five-hour source because it had a right ascension of almost, it had a right ascension near 5 hours. It was about 4 hours and 50-something minutes.
Right.
And Minkowski visited Jodrell, and we talked to him about it.
Now, what time would this, what year would this be, roughly? Was this at the Jodrell Bank meeting, perhaps, in 55?
Yes, I think it probably was, yes. Yes. We got from him a copy of one of the 48-inch Schmidt plates, which had a vague outline of this source on, and I remember we wrote a little note for Nature, and we kind of copied the outline of that source. That was the first thing you'll have on there for me. It's
large angular radio sources near the galactic plane.
Galactic sources of large angular diameter is the,
right,
is the name of it.
In Nature.
Yes, in Nature.
In 54. But now that would be before. If Minkowski had visited you, then that was...
No, well, we don't, no, I think, no, maybe I got it wrong. That same year, 1952, I think Hanbury had been to the United States, and he talked with Bader and Minkowski, and I remember him coming back and telling us about the optical identifications of these early sources.
Right, Cygnus and Canis,
And it could have been that that it was a result of correspondence, that subsequent correspondence that Minkowski sent us this photograph. But
what was the photograph of? Which source? This 5-hour source?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
And what does this turn out to be in modern day terms?
Well, to tell you the truth,
it's a supernova remnant, I guess.
Yes, and it's centered on the star Alpha Auriga. Wait a minute. No, it's not. It's centered on BD 46 degrees 949.
But it's in the constellation of Auriga.
It's near Auriga. It's at about declination between 46 and 47 degrees, and right ascension about 4 hours and 58 minutes.
Okay, I'll have to check that out.
But,
I remember this, though. This was a supernova remnant that was studied often in the 50s.
I think that what happened was that, as far as my memory of meeting Minkowski was, he did come over later for that particular meeting, the 1955 right. meeting, and we saw him again then. That was kind of an interesting meeting. We were all at...
Well, since you brought it up, and before I forget, can you tell me why was it an interesting meeting?
Well, for me, because it was the first time I'd been to an international meeting, and there were all of these important people like Minkowski and Greenstein and Bader and so forth, who were the great men mm-hmm. whom one had heard of, and what one had the opportunity to see some of them and meet some of them. I remember Fred Haddock was there and talking about some measurements he'd done at 10 centimeters, which was just an incredibly short wavelength in those days. That those were done with the old Naval Observatory dish.
Right.
That was when he was with the Naval Observatory.
Or NRL.
I beg your pardon, NRL, Naval Research Lab, that's right. And I also remember at that meeting that I think it was Minkowski and Greenstein read a paper on some ideas they had for mechanisms of radio emission, in which they were trying to get the spectrum from some kind of a mixture of thermal sources in a partly optically thick plasma.
Right. You're right.
And I remember that after that there was a paper by, I suppose, maybe it was Slavsky or one of his colleagues. If it wasn't Slavsky, it was another Russian who always used to come to meetings in those early days and read papers for his colleagues. I've forgotten what his name was. Anyhow, after it, I remember...
Proposing synchrotron radiation.
Yeah, proposing synchrotron radiation. That's right. And I remember Minkowski getting up and saying that I think we should withdraw our paper, don't you, Jesse? And Jesse got up and said yes. And it seemed kind of interesting that these guys were so willing to...
as soon as they heard about this, it was clear to them that this was superior.
That was much superior, and I was kind of impressed by that. I remember.
That's interesting. I never heard that story before. Who else? What about the whole Australians? You've never met any of them, I suppose.
No, that's right. Mills and Christensen were there, and they were interested. Mills was interested in seeing our interferometer. Ryle was there. I guess that Paul Wilde was there. I met him subsequently
Yes, he was. Because I just interviewed him.
I remember. See.
And also Joe Pozzi was there.
Ah, that's right, yes. And Bolton was there. Mm-hmm. And Bolton at the time was talking about getting some dishes going in California, which, of course, eventually did.
What about, you mentioned that Ryle was there. Is the implication that you hadn't had much contact with Cambridge until it took an international meeting to get...
Well, I had
contact between the two groups.
No, there was some contact, but not a lot. I had met him before. Hanbury knew him; they were on good terms. I think there'd always been a little bit of question as to whether pencil beams or interferometers were the things to use for sky surveys, mm-hmm. Ryle using the interferometer and the pencil beam, Hanbury using the pencil beam of the 280-foot dish. I don't know. Ryle was very interested when we told him. We were just beginning to get this. These results, I think, at that time about the we'd already resolved out the big sources, and we knew the answer about why Ryle couldn't see them, and that seemed like an interesting step forward. And then we were going to go on and press on and see whether these other sources were of the nature of Cygnus and Cassiopeia, which of course start to resolve out fairly quickly, and we found, of course, that they didn't.
So Ryle was willing to accept that there was a class of sources that his interferometer was not sensitive to.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. He may have thought they weren't very important. I don't know. But sure. Yes, he accepted that. Of course, he was interested in the cosmological aspects. That's why I say he might have thought they were particularly important at that time. Let's see. What was I going to say? had some very crude ideas in mind, like. The intensities of some of these sources suggested they might be like objects like Cygnus, but ten times as far away, and therefore the angular diameter might be on the order of one-tenth that of Cygnus, and we were getting down to a few arc seconds. So we were beginning to hit that, but really I left at about. Before really we got much further with that experiment. And Rosen, Barry Rosen, mm-hmm. Came along and joined Palmer on that.
Right.
Palmer had gone to Jodrell Bank the year I did, by the way. He had been doing work at Cambridge on weather.
Right,
physics,
yes.
On cloud physics.
So when did you leave Jodrell? What year?
It must have been. Excuse me a moment. I got my PhD the year after. Let me just get this right. I got my PhD. It was 1955 that I left Jodrell. I left in at the end of the year, and I went to work for EMI. It was the. Let's see, the name of the company was EMI Electronics Development Company, and that the EMI stood for Electrical and Musical Industries Limited. And we worked on a guided weapons project there for about a year and a half. Let's see. And then I got my PhD the following summer. I had written my thesis before I left, but Minkowski was going to be coming over again, and Lovell and Hanbury decided that he could be my external examiner,
right.
Yes. So that went off perfectly well. He was a delightful guy, a very nice guy to have for an external examiner.
Can you tell me about this exam?
I can't remember too many things about it. We talked a little bit about the distribution of radio sources in the sky and things like that. And he thought it was quite a useful piece of work to have separated these at least two classes of radio sources by diameters.
How did you see these classes as relating to Mills's classes 1 and 2? Remember, he had this scheme between the large. Tended to be large size associated with the galactic plane.
Well, I think they were very much the same. Well, Mills had some galactic and some extragalactic, and we were essentially dealing with the same thing.
So, although you said that in a sense you were competitors, you didn't really disagree very much.
Oh no, we didn't. No, I mean the using the word competitive. There was the kind of the technological competition of how far apart can you get two antennas and still make an interferometer. That would have been the extent to which we were competing.
But in terms of the scientific interpretation of it, you were coming to basically the same.
Oh yeah, I think so. Yeah, we never had any disagreement, we were looking essentially at different sources. I don't know whether there was anything common to our two lists. Oh, wait a moment. Did Mills see Cygnus? Yes, I guess he did.
You could just see it. Yeah.
Yeah. So there were some. Some were the same, and some were different. So.
But there was no. Unlike the 2C versus the Mills survey.
Yeah,
in
there was
the
no
area
problem.
Overlap, there
yeah.
was not.
No,
really
there was
great
no,
disagreement.
There's no disagreement. No.
Now, one thing you mentioned earlier was about cable versus. Radio links.
Yes.
And did you use cable out to some point? And
yeah, we did. That's right.
How far out could you go with cable, and then why did you switch over?
Well, if I looked in my thesis, which I should have brought with me, I realize now, I could have told you where we changed over. But the cable we were using was just a thin 50 ohm television feeder type coax. That was nice to start with for short distances because you didn't have to worry about making transmitters and receivers for the radio link, and there was no problem about interference. But as you go very far, the attenuation increases exponentially in a cable at so many dBs per foot.
Right.
And so you get to a stage where, well, it's a mixture of the problem of stringing cables across roads and things. So the attenuation. I don't think we went beyond the first one or two stations. There were some stations fairly close to Jodrell and one in a field up behind where we used the cable. Just trying to remember, we eventually had to go to radio link. I don't just remember
maybe
exactly
a mile or
where.
Something like that.
Yeah, something like roughly that. Yes, yes.
And okay, now another whole subject we haven't brought up is the rotating lobe interferometer. The concept. Where did the concept come from, and was it pretty straightforward to implement, and so forth? I mean,
well,
it was a new thing.
Okay. We realized, of course, that the lobes would get so fast that the sources would get lost in the noise because they'd just be very quick wiggles. The problem was that, of course, we weren't using no computer or anything to record the output.
Right.
We just had a pen recorder, and one wanted to keep a fairly long time constant to reduce the noise in the output.
So even a high-speed strip chart wouldn't solve the problem.
That's right. No. You wanted the long time constant, so you wanted to slow down the fringes. And I have forgotten whether there was Henry, myself, and Harmer, and I don't know which of us particularly thought of it. It turned out to be not a very difficult thing to implement in our case, because the way the interferometer was made, we had a small frequency offset between the local oscillators at the two ends.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was about a kilohertz.
Yeah.
And then when you brought together the two IFs and multiplied them together, coherent radiation produced a kilohertz beat frequency.
Right.
And then we put that into a phase-sensitive detector. Together with the reference from the beat of the two local oscillators. Now, this was we originally thought of doing this as being having the advantages of phase switching, in that it got rid of the DC component in the output, but being somewhat simpler to do. You didn't need any to build any phase switches ahead of the front end.
Right.
So it turned out, of course, that all you had to do was to change the phase of the 10 kilohertz reference to rotate the fringes. So we had an old mag slip resolver, which was a bit of old army surplus equipment, which was used for measuring rough angles of guns and gut maps and things like that. And we were able to use that as being a kind of transformer with a rotating secondary to put a phase change in. But if you do, you have that picture there I can actually show you. It was driven by a thing called a velodyne, which was a servo motor which you could run at various speeds. Henry Palmer used to set it up to the right speed, I think, by twiddling a potentiometer and looking at his watch as we went. Is that the right line? No, this is the right one. Here they are, sorry, I've got the wrong bunch. This device here is it. This thing here is the velodyne, which is driving through a Meccano gearbox back here. And this was the mag slip resolver, which did the change. On this gear here, if you're interested,
look at these old tubes. Wow.
Now that's a power supply. Those are power supplies. Power supplies at the bottom. Signals from the 280 foot dish came in here. There was a preamp here. The preamps we used were always a cascode circuit of a triode followed by a pentode. Normally one used a 6AK5 pentode, which was strapped as a triode, which made a very good input stage, and that was followed by a grounded grid triode. And the two together made a thing called a cascode. Well, anyhow, this end rack here was for the signals from the 218 foot dish. Signals from the radio link came in at this opposite end here, and these two IF strips here, which are that's on the left hand side of the photograph, were to do with receiving the LO and IF signals that came in over the radio link, and then back up here, the two things were multiplied together in a behind a panel up here, and the recorder here had as you notice, there's an old loudspeaker.
Screwed
to the back of the chart recorder, and the chart recorders had a certain amount of stiction in them, and that was driven at 60 hertz and rattled on the back to keep the pen from sticking. other people in the building used to complain that it was
it hummed
and made a noisy rattling noise, but it was very, very, very effective.
Okay, so and let me also ask you about sort of division of duties. It's between this group of Hanbury, Brown, Palmer, and Thompson. Was sort of everyone in on everything, or was it?
Well, I was kind of the electronic, the main radio engineer there. Hanbury really just was the advisor to Henry Palmer and I. I built most of the equipment. Henry helped to get it going, and really did a lot of work in running it, and Hanbury essentially just advised us.
And what about the scientific interpretation? Was that sort of an equal as to what you were getting, or?
I think it was more or less equal. Hanbury, as I say, knew Minkowski and had the advantage of knowing some of the radio astronomers. I remember, though, that in those days I had a file of every paper on radio astronomy that had been published. And at one stage I'd read them all.
that was possible then, yeah.
It was possible. It was possible up to about 1955.
Right. Let me ask about how you saw the problem. If you can try to put yourself back in those days, what did you see radio astronomy as a field? I mean, what were its main problems to be resolved? Was it simply to find out the nature of the radio sources, or?
What
were the critical problems as you saw?
I think so. Naturally, I thought the experiment that I was working on was pretty important, trying to find the nature of the small unresolved sources, the ones that appeared to be isotropic, were they like Cygnus or were they something entirely different? Incidentally, I remember that during about the last year that I was at Jadro, Martin Ryle announced the results of the 2C survey,
that's right,
the
55.
Infamous 2C right. survey. And we, several of us from Jadro, went down to London and listened to that presentation.
RAS meeting.
Yes, it was at the, that's right, and it was at the Royal Astronomical Society's headquarters on Piccadilly. And I remember being very impressed with it all. I was quite young then, I guess, and I hadn't much experience of science. And I remember thinking that they'd catalogued all these radio sources. They'd looked at astronomical plates and where they were, and most of them were. I think there were practically no identifications.
Right.
And I remember thinking, well, I guess this is this winds up radio astronomy.
sort of ties it all up.
But how wrong could you be? I remember thinking that. Several of us went down. Lovell went down, and DeHambry and Palmer and myself.
I wouldn't expect that someone like Hanbury would have thought this.
Oh, I'm sure he didn't, right. And I'm sure none of them did, no, yeah. except I mean, that was what I thought.
Right. You were getting out of the field at that time, though. I guess you knew that.
Well, I was. I don't. Look, I'm just trying to remember exactly.
I think it was the fall of '55 when he gave that talk.
Yes, I also have a memory of that. Of that meeting, that there were two very vociferous and I may say struck me as being somewhat shabbily dressed gentlemen got up on the front row and had a very great deal to say. I wondered just what they were doing in this meeting. And I learned out afterwards that they were Bondi and I think it was Gold.
Gold, yeah,
yes.
Tom Gold, yeah. You just didn't know them.
I just didn't know them. No. That was another little interesting thing that I remember.
I'm still struck by the fact that the intensity interferometer had revealed that Cygnus was perhaps a double anyway. It modeled as a double nicely,
yes.
And it was asymmetric in its
yes.
distribution. And apparently you weren't worrying about that too much
in
your longer and longer baseline.
The feeling was that you had to resolve them. As long as you couldn't resolve the source, there didn't seem to be too much point in worrying what direction you were observing. It's quite true. Maybe you couldn't resolve it east west. Maybe you would have done north south. But we had a limited number of places we could go to.
Right, and you had several sources also.
And we had about a dozen.
Right.
So they wouldn't have all resolved at the same angle. So it was kind of a Monte Carlo situation.
Right.
Almost.
Right. How were these dozen chosen?
Oh, they were from Henry Brown's paper, and they were the stronger ones in it.
And they were the ones that had survived, obviously, in terms of
yes, that's
still
right.
showing principles.
Yes, that's right. And as I say, that we found practically no sources, I think, except Cygnus and Cassiopeia, which. Resolved out nicely at intermediate baselines. We either couldn't get the antennas close enough together or far enough apart.
And so then, once again, as much as you can remember how you felt at that time in 1955 when you had this collection of a dozen sources which were only a few arc seconds or less than that in size, did this seem to prove to you that conclusively they must be outside the galaxy, very distant sources, or were you sort of open as to their nature?
Well, they had been. They were. Ryle had shown that these type of sources were more or less isotropically distributed. So it was generally thought at the time they were very close to the sun, or else they were wide outside the galaxy. And,
right.
And I think it seemed very unlikely that they were very close to the sun, since they were. That there were no optical counterparts of them,
However, this made for tremendous luminosities, of course.
That's right, yes. But then, as I say, one looked at Cygnus and said, these things were a few percent of Cygnus in flux density. If you had Cygnus objects 10 times as far away, you would be down to a few arc seconds. And
you wouldn't see them on the sky survey or on the Palomar photographs even.
That's right. And they would be of comparable intensity to these things that we were looking at. And that was about as far as we theorized.
Yeah. So you were not thinking of radio stars, really, in your mind as you worked on these things?
No, no. Yeah. Because, as I say, that summer of 72, Bader and Minkowski had identified Cygnus, Cassiopeia, the Crab, and there was nothing that went with stars.
Let me ask you about this 57 paper in Observatory. It's been said that this was a key paper in the sense that, as you know, a few of these turned out to be quasars later on,
and
certainly that was not known at that time, but it was known that these were the smallest sources that had been measured. Do you see this as having been important in directing the field at that point, or is it only in retrospect that one goes back and says that they had isolated these sources?
Well, the experiment didn't stop when I left Jodrell. Morris had joined the group, I said earlier, didn't I, that Rosen joined the group.
Yes.
In fact, he didn't right away. Rosen came in and did another experiment using an interferometer at 10 centimeters wavelength. And it wasn't until he'd finished that and got his PhD that he joined Palmer. Mm-hmm. And that was after I'd left.
Right.
But Morris joined about the time that I left. But that experiment went on. And
so this was just a way station, really, are you saying, then, in longer and longer baselines?
Yes. Well, I was essentially responsible for building and setting up the first equipment in that interferometer experiment, which continued, and I think you could say is continuing in a rather evolved form now at Jodrell Bank.
But I guess what I want to get at is this few arc second limit, is that more important than the other limits? Did it, or was it only that you happened to write a little paper at that stage in terms of what it was able to establish scientifically?
I think we thought of the limits of the angular diameter as being one of the important physical properties that you could actually go out and measure.
But the particular value of a few arc seconds, did you look upon that as being significant? For instance, you were saying before in comparison with Cygnus A.
I think we did, thinking in those terms, yes.
Okay.
And if they turned out to be smaller, then they would indeed be objects with somewhat more remarkable properties than Cygnus.
And so you might not have been surprised if they'd all begun to resolve at that point. And then you
that's
would say,
right.
They're just Cygnus A's.
That's right. That's one thing we might
okay.
have thought, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, is there any other aspect of what you worked on at Jodrell in terms of the publications here?
Oh, I remember one other thing that happened. Whilst we were there, we had a visitor from the Soviet Union who was interested in polarization. And that was, let me see, what? And that set us on to doing some polarization measurements. And we must have been one of the first people to look for polarization in radio sources. We used our same interferometer. We used our same electronics, but we used two different antennas. There was on the top of the generator house at Jodrell, and we generate our own electric power with diesels mm-hmm. there. An antenna which had the property that you could rotate it around its own axis. It was about a 20-foot paraboloid.
I think it's still up there, if I remember from a couple of years ago.
You're probably right.
There's a dish on top of the generator.
And it's rather like a flower on a stalk,
yeah.
and you
yeah.
can rotate it about the stalk, as it were. And then there was another parabola which had been made by the machine shop staff at Jodrell, which was eventually became one of Rosen's two dishes for his 10-centimeter work. But you could rotate that as well. We put two feeds in each of these, two cross dipoles at 158, and connected them to our interferometer system. And we looked at Cygnus, Cass, and Taurus.
Who was this Russian, do you remember?
Well, wait a minute, I'm looking in my...
This was in connection with synchrotron theory, I suppose.
Yes, well, I'm looking at the paper in which you wrote it up, and there's Dombrowski,